In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. On average, 10% of children aren't the genetic offspring of their supposed biological fathers. That's 1 out of 10 people you may know. It could be almost a billion people worldwide. In 1996, Professor Robin Baker published the book Sperm Wars, The Science of Sex, and it essentially elaborates on sperm competition theory. If competition is heritable, females fertilized by the most competitive sperm will gain through greater reproductive success of their sons. There are three categories of sperm: egg getters, killers, and blockers. A study in the UK showed that 4% of people are conceived through sperm warfare. This internal dynamic is known to drive subconscious behavior and shapes the sexuality of every man, woman, and child. The research behind these concepts that began in 1985 examined million-year-old programming coded into human biology. Some cultures condemn infidelity and masturbation. However, these acts have been found to be ancient strategic advantages toward successful human reproduction. We hear part two of the interview with Dr. Baker about his book, Sperm Wars, The Science of Sex. We get into more edgier material and touch on the hashtag MeToo movement. Professor Robin Baker is an evolutionary biologist who authored nearly 100 scientific papers, 6 academic books, and is the author of 4 popular science books, Sperm Wars, Baby Wars, Sex in the Future, and Fragile Science. Dr. Robin Baker, welcome to part 2 of this interview on In Other News.
Well, it's nice to be part of your program. Thank you for inviting me.
As unpleasant as it might be for some listening, would you tell listeners what was learned about flowback and how that intentional pushing out of sperm was found to be important to successful reproduction strategy?
Flowback, yes, that was, really was a second most exciting eureka moment, I think. Realizing the importance of this phenomenon. When Mark Bezos and I first started our work on human sperm competition, started our real work collecting sperm, sperm competition was still very much something that people thought of in male terms, the competition between sperm from two males. Lots of theories had been produced about the sort of things that might happen inside other animals. And one of the favorites was that in animals that had higher levels of sperm competition, more sperm, you would find that the males regularly put in more sperm than in animals that had less sperm competition. And by and large, this study in other animals had been found to be correct. The theory had been found to be correct. So we followed up this idea that everything was sort of male-driven for our work on humans. People looked at it as if, the female goes out and collects sperm from two different males, but then everything that happens inside her is male-driven. It's what the males are doing, like the number of sperm they put in and so on. And we continued along this line when we first started, I have to admit. And our first real experiment was we got together a fair number of couples and asked them to collect sperm during intercourse for us. In other words, just don't throw away your condoms. Give them to us. Let's count the sperm that are in those condoms. And we'd ask them various questions and so on. And one of the questions that we asked was, how much time have you spent with each other since your last copulation, since the last time you had sex? Because our prediction would be that the less time they'd spent together, the less percentage of time they'd spent together, the greater the chance that the woman could have had sex with somebody else. So the risk of sperm competition was greater the less time the man had spent with her since his last copulation with her. And therefore, we would expect, well, our prediction was, that the man should produce, should inseminate more sperm during sex than if he'd spent nearly all his time with her between those copulations. And this was our first publication on the matter, and the theory was well supported. We did all the necessary controls and so on, and this was all really exciting. Men were obviously adjusting how many sperm they were putting into a woman, depending on what the risk of sperm competition was. And it was around about this time that a female colleague of ours said, well, I don't know why men are bothering to adjust the number of sperm that they put into a woman, because nearly all of it comes back out anyway, doesn't it? It suddenly clicked. You see, we'd been thinking everything was male-driven, but suddenly we had this possibility that the woman might actually be adjusting the numbers of sperm that she retained by getting rid of some of those that are inseminated into her. Now, most people know, we went on to call this the flowback. Most women are very aware of the flowback. It's the wet sheet phenomenon. It dribbles down the leg when you don't want it to. But the main ejection, the main loss of sperm occurs during the first urination after sex. And whereas the flowback had previously been thought of as something really passive, just something that happens. In fact, medically, it was a cause for some concern that this flowback occurred at all. Women worried that they were losing the sperm that they'd received and it would reduce their fertility in some way. But if you watch what happens when a woman urinates after sex, of course, the sperm is in the vagina, the urine comes out of the urethra. So they're coming out of two different places. When the woman first urinates after sex, you see these two things coming out with great force. The urine comes out near the front and the semen comes out through the vagina, and you're left in absolutely no doubt that the woman is ejecting this. It's not a passive loss at all. She is ejecting this sperm. She's getting rid of some of the sperm. So our question to ourselves immediately was, well, how much is she losing? And does it vary at all? Because if it did vary, and it varied in accordance with things that she was doing, it meant that the woman, totally unconsciously, had some control over the number of sperm that she retained. So this colleague of ours set about finding ways of standardising the collection of semen and the sperm it contained after intercourse. And because by then we had done enough experiments with the number of sperm that men inseminated during copulation, we could predict mathematically with sufficient accuracy just about how many sperm a man would put in on any given occasion if we had enough information. And if we then could collect the flowbacks and count how many sperm were in that, then by subtracting one from the other, we could work out how many sperm stayed in the woman. And lo and behold, we found that the number of sperm that comes out does vary quite a lot. It averages about 50%, let's say, just to make it easy. There's a lot more could be said, but let's say about 50%. And this is the material that comes out about 45 minutes after intercourse. But sometimes nearly all of the sperm come out. And if you collect flowback from pregnant women who have, where the sperm can't get through the cervix door, you find that that nearly all sperm come out. You can count as many coming out as you calculated went in. And we investigated what sort of things influence the number of sperm that a woman retained after intercourse, and we found that it ended up quite a complicated story, but it was affected by whether or not she had an orgasm, during intercourse, whether she'd had an orgasm in the hours or days before intercourse, things like that. And it allowed us to work out the ways in which women were actually controlling how much sperm from intercourse to intercourse they were retaining. Now, you see, for a woman with a partner, this doesn't matter that much because you don't need many sperm to just fertilize an egg. But if she is having sperm with two different men, her partner and a lover, then if she retains more sperm from one man than the other, then she's going to bias the chances of fertilization in favor of one of those men. And we found that masturbation and whether she had an orgasm or not before or during sex all made a difference. They turned out to be female strategies as to controlling the amount of sperm she retained. We found out important things like not having an orgasm could be as strategic as having an orgasm, for example, and masturbating or could also have an effect on the number of sperm she retained. So the flowback was in fact the basis for some female control over the outcome of sperm competition. And it put the whole thing in a completely new light, because before that it had all been focused on men. Now we had to consider the woman's contribution to it as well. And also, of course, it meant that this flowback was no longer a medical problem. It was something the woman was actually doing, and it was an important part of her sexual behavior.
Professor Baker, some of the hashtag MeToo movement allegations describe open displays of male masturbation. And interestingly, you referenced this behavior in context of an indicator women look for in the health of men or to check if their partner is cheating on them. I realize that this is slightly out of context in terms of mutual consent, but looking only at this scientifically may show something else. Based on your research, what are your thoughts on the unconscious drivers of this culturally unacceptable behavior?
Well, this is a good question, of course, because not specifically because of the way it relates to masturbation, but it raises the whole question of how should we, as a modern society, react to behaviours that have evolved for very good reasons in the past, but now don't fit very comfortably with what we consider to be normal, acceptable behaviour. But masturbation is a good way of illustrating the pros and cons of the situation. The first thing we've got to realise is that all male primates masturbate. They display the fact that they're doing so in front of others, males, females, whatever, and they do it for a reason. And also, females watch them for a reason. Now, the reason males masturbate in front of others in primate societies is first of all, attract their attention to show that they are primed and ready for sex, and to show that they are capable of performing sexual acts and are reasonably healthy and so on. I'll get back to that in a minute. Females watch them because they are collecting information about the different males. They can see which males are healthy and which aren't. Again, I'll get back to that in a second. So it's an advantage to both males and females that this behaviour occurs. And the earliest anthropologists meeting naked tribes for the first time reported exactly this sort of behaviour happening with humans. And being humans, they would go even further. There were masturbatory contests to see which males could shoot their semen the furthest, or who could pull along the heaviest rocks tied to their erect penises, and so on. They were all displays of potency of some sort, and females would pay attention to this behaviour. Now, of course, since we became clothed, since other values became established in human society, which we're not talking that long ago, we're just talking a couple of thousand years ago, perhaps, the attitude towards public displays of, must say, masturbation, have changed. Now we have the situation where, whether we like it or not, males still have the urges to display this or that aspect of their sexual prowess. And females still, on occasion, gain some advantage from watching this. Now, within a couple, a well-established couple, this is all perfectly... I doubt if many women would want their male partners no longer to behave this way in front of them. Because females can pick up quite a lot of information from what they see. First of all, the fact that the male can get an erection. Secondly, that he can produce semen. They can tell a lot about the health of his semen from the colour of his semen. They can also, rather more subtly, once they get used to what their male produces, by seeing how much semen comes out on each occasion, they may even pick up information on whether he is cheating on them or not. So females get some advantage from seeing males in these sort of acts. Now, the question is, how does this relate to our current social mores? And I think it would be true to say that what we're talking about in the sort of displays that men now get prosecuted for, they still have the urges, but they can get prosecuted for showing them as randomly as they would have done if they were a naked primate out in a group. What we have here is more, as you suggested in your question, a question of consent. Nowadays, this behaviour is only acceptable if it is consensual to both of the parties. And this is what the objections are about, I think, rather than the fact that men do have these urges and occasionally they show them to people who are quite happy to see them showing these urges, showing this behaviour.
It's fascinating to learn about natural conception, and you juxtaposed it against the way stress is a natural mediator to family planning in scene 16. This may not be easy to understand because the body is once again taking over family planning decisions. Would you tell listeners about this, please?
You see, for this sort of female mammal, it is very easy to overstretch herself by having too many offspring. If she tries to raise six, it may be so difficult that disease or starvation or something means that she ends up only managing to raise three. Whereas if she had only tried to raise four, she wouldn't have stretched herself so much, and she might have actually been able to manage to raise those four. And so by trying to raise fewer, she would actually end up with more young surviving. This would have applied to humans in hunter-gatherer times, for example. So it's important, first of all, that a female tries only to raise the optimum number of young that she can manage, and also the optimum for the environment that she's in, the amount of food that's available, amount of water, amount of space, freedom from predators, and so on. That is what evolution aims at, to get her to produce the optimum number of young. And the way evolution has managed to do this is to link the chances of conception and of the successful pregnancy and getting through to giving birth to the child to good times in the environment. So the best thing such a female can do is to time having her young, getting pregnant, having her young, with good times in the environment and avoiding getting pregnant at times that the environment is bad. Now, fortunately, there is a single link for all of this, and we would call it stress, because all of the situations in which it's a bad time to conceive and try and raise a child are stressful times. They're times where there is all of these bad things happening in the environment, food, famine, drought, etc. And so evolution has linked what's going on inside her body with the level of stress. So, for example, there are several points in the conception to giving birth process that the body can do something about. For example, a woman ovulates more or less in mid-cycle, mid-menstrual cycle, but she doesn't always ovulate. Sometimes she does, sometimes she doesn't. And what is happening is that if she's overstressed during that middle part of the cycle when she would normally ovulate, the body says, right, don't produce an egg. We won't produce an egg. We'll just go through the cycle and we'll try again next month. We'll see what the situation is like next month. So she doesn't produce an egg. Or if it's okay at the time of conception and she produces an egg and that egg is fertilized by sperm, but then the environment deteriorates, she gets stressed after that, then the body has a mechanism for just letting the egg pass straight through her womb. It doesn't implant. So therefore, again, she doesn't get pregnant. Even if it starts to implant and if things get stressed during the very earliest stages of pregnancy, she can release the egg and it can flow out of the body and no pregnancy. Also, as many people know, and it's a very distressing affair, during the first 3 months of pregnancy, the first trimester, it's relatively easy for the body to get rid of any fetus that is in there. So if things get really stressful during those 3 months, it's got another opportunity to say, okay, let's not go ahead with this pregnancy. Let's get rid of this fetus and then try again in a month or two when things are better. So there are all of these steps where it is possible for the body to read the stress that the woman's going through and to then do something about making it more or less difficult for her to conceive and get pregnant. And even after a female in this category of post-pregnancy care has had a child, there is still an opportunity to say, no, things are too bad. I can't raise this child or this litter or whatever. People who have pets like rats and hamsters and rabbits will be only too aware that if they're not careful and if they stress their pet too much when the female is giving birth, they'll get up the following morning and find that the female has actually eaten all her young, because rather than try and raise them, it's better for her to, because things have been so stressful at that time, it's better for her to not raise this particular litter and wait for another time. And of course, the same is true for humans. Everybody is very aware that those first few months after pregnancy, a woman goes through a very, well, how do I feel about this sort of time? We call it postnatal depression, the psychological situation that can arise. And it is characterized by females often feeling quite aggressive towards their young during that time. And legal system the world over and throughout history have recognized that women during those first few months after having a child are a lot more likely to abandon the child or even to kill it. In Victorian London, for example, the data show quite clearly that the level of infanticide that was going on, it was said to be almost the main form of family planning at that time. To reduce the family to a manageable size, women used to abandon or even kill their young. So although the brain isn't involved in any of these things in a major sense, the body is doing most of it in a hormonal way. There are a range of natural family planning mechanisms that try to make it that women only conceive, go through pregnancy, give birth and keep the child when times are good. And if things are very stressful, then effectively they are saying, no, we'll do it later. Nowadays, fortunately, we have contraception that can bring it into the conscious realm. But there were all these subconscious mechanisms that evolved a long time before there were any contraceptives.
And in a past interview with author of The Boy Crisis, Dr. Warren Farrell, he emphasized the importance of horseplay with children and their fathers, and how long-term studies showed better boundaries as adults. In the chapter, Learning the Gropes, of your book, Sperm Wars, you reference how the female mink won't ovulate until there's some type of physical trauma, and that essentially their bodies are on hold for the right male to inseminate them. I was curious about how the importance of horseplay or rough and tumble activity could also prepare young men for reproductive success with women. Would you please talk about this?
Horseplay, it's not a very scientific term, of course, but I guess we all know what we mean by horseplay. It's a sort of any sort of playful type behavior, but that has a rough and tumble element to it, a sort of rolling around and pushing and shoving, that sort of thing, but in a play sort of atmosphere rather than a serious one. Now, it's another of these areas where evolved behavior, the urges and the instincts that go along with it, they don't sit comfortably in alongside modern social mores, because of course when adults engage in horseplay, it's got either aggressive connotations like real fighting and an urge to damage each other, or it's got sexual connotations to it, where it's a preliminary to sexual intercourse even, but a part of play between the sexes. So you only have to watch young children, almost from toddlership upwards, to see that they do from time to time, and some more than others, have real urges, a real need to engage in horseplay, in rough and tumble behaviour. They spend a lot of time doing it with each other, and occasionally they do it with adults as well, including their parents and their elder brothers and sisters. And this is all part of a learning curve of preparing themselves for the more serious wrestling and with same sex or other sex in sexual or aggressive situations that they will have to cope with in later life. And it's important to realize that although evolution can shape the urges and the instincts and the feelings that you really want to behave in this way, it doesn't shape a lot of the details. If we get away from humans for the moment and think about, say, something like a chimpanzee, it has evolved all the sexual urges that it needs to be able to have sex and reproduce. But if you isolate a young chimpanzee from older individuals so that it doesn't see any sex going on around it, it doesn't see what older individuals do, then when it comes to its turn to have sex, it has no idea what to do. It has all the right sexual urges, but it has no idea what to do with them. And you if it's a male, they don't know where to put their penis, you know, they don't even know which end of the female to do it. They need to have seen older individuals having sex, or they need to have experimented earlier on before they can take advantage of any sexual opportunities that occur to them later in life. And a lot of this comes from sort of playing with their siblings and with older individuals and just generally practicing and observing. I think you could see where I'm going, where in that it doesn't fit in with modern social mores. But you do have to remember that until relatively recently in human evolution, in some tribes, only just a couple of hundred years ago, but for most of humanity, we can go back 2,000 or 3,000 years, it was totally normal for youngsters to see adults having sex around them. People were naked, they weren't living in houses, and life was going on about them. So children then got all of their experience just from the wider community. Now, of course, nobody's suggesting that modern society should change to accommodate that. It's not acceptable in modern society for children to watch adults having sex, and that's where we are. But it doesn't alter the fact that the instincts that they gained that evolved were usually combined with getting experience from seeing what's going on around them. Now that's no longer possible. And so the experience at learning comes from contemporaries during childhood and from older individuals where they can experiment with things just sort of rolling around and just playing in a fairly safe environment, such as the children and father that are mentioned in the question. Rough and tumble isn't as much part of sexual behaviour in humans as it is in some animals. There are mammals that exist where the mink, for example, where rough and tumble between male and female is an essential part of sexual behaviour. The female mink, she won't actually ovulate unless she suffers some sort of trauma at a male's hand. She has got the egg there all waiting to be popped out and ovulate to be fertilised, but it doesn't happen until she's had an aggressive interaction with a male that has caused a sufficient trauma, a bite or something like that, that he's managed to overcome her resistance and she then ovulates and gets fertilised. Now, fortunately, that's not part of human sexual behaviour, but you get the idea that rough and tumble can be part of preparation for adult behaviour. And where can youngsters get this sort of experience these days apart from with their contemporaries, their siblings and their parents?
Professor Baker, what are your thoughts on why evolutionary biology is heavily criticised?
Yes, I've been dogged all my life, I suppose, by this attitude towards evolutionary biology. I mean, there are all sorts of things that people say about evolutionary biology. For a start, of course, it involves evolution. So that means that there's going to be a portion of the general population that has a bad attitude towards it anyway, because evolutionary biology assumes that evolution takes place and works from there. And of course, a lot of people would disagree with that. Even amongst the scientists of biologists, evolutionary biology still, particularly in the early years, had a fairly bad press. Partly the problem was that we were trying to explain things that had happened in the past, at the beginning. We were trying to make sense of why everything had evolved in the way it did. How did evolution work? What selective pressures acted on it? What effect did it have on reproductive success? And so on. And people said, yes, but this isn't the scientific method. This is just collecting together lots of information and trying to make sense of it. It was put down as being just a collection of just-so stories in a Kipling sense. But it's no different, actually, from the problem that climate scientists have had recently, because they too have effectively built their arguments on what has happened in the past and trying to make sense of it in terms of what is happening now. So we both have the same sort of problem, but evolutionary biology has moved on from that because to start, we weren't doing things like setting up hypotheses and making predictions and then testing them in a rigorous scientific way. We were just explaining things from the past. But over the recent decades, evolutionary biology has, if you like, joined mainstream science in that it has found ways of building up models of evolution in the past and then using those models to make predictions of what we would expect to find out there and then going out and finding it and, wherever possible, setting up experiments, usually with insects and so on, that artificially produce evolution and see what happens. And we can see if our predictions are matched, in which case we are using a scientific method. And so it shouldn't be dismissed in the way that it was in the early years. In the study of sperm competition, I guess the best example is one of the earliest models that was produced said that because species varies, let's just talk about primates for the moment, because primates vary over the level of sperm competition that they show. Some have relatively small amounts of sperm competition. They're monogamous, and the females, although they are unfaithful, they're not that unfaithful, maybe not even as unfaithful as humans. Other species, of course, like chimpanzees, they live in groups containing of lots of males, lots of females, and completely free intercourse between them all. And females will mate maybe with every male within the group at each conception. So there's a lot of sperm competition. And one of the earliest models that was produced said, we're in species that experience a lot of sperm competition, male testis size will be greater than in species that have relatively little sperm competition. Because, fairly obviously, in species with a lot of sperm competition, the male who produces most sperm is more likely to win competitions. But to produce lots of sperm, the male has to have large testes. But testes do cost something to reproduce, and carrying around large testes is also quite expensive. There's the risk of damaging the testes, and they're heavier to carry around and so on. So if you don't have a lot of sperm competition, there's an advantage in males having smaller testes. So the prediction was, let's go out, let's look at the primates around us, measure the size of their testes relative to the size of their bodies, and see if this is true. Those with large testes have more sperm competition. And that prediction was proved to be correct, not only now in primates, but in lots of different animal groups. The more sperm competition, the larger the testes. So evolutionary biology is just as much a science as any other part of science, now that we have learned how to investigate it. I was a biologist by training, and I became interested in humans, and I'm still most comfortable when I'm comparing humans with other animals rather than just looking at humans themselves. I feel happier that we can get the sort of studies that allow us to make predictions of how humans fit in with other species than I am just looking at humans themselves. But even so, now there's a whole new field of evolutionary biology, which we would call evolutionary psychology, which just looks at the evolution of humans themselves, including their behaviour, of course, and the sort of attitudes that they have. And evolutionary psychology is now suffering the same sort of criticisms that evolutionary biology as a whole did in the first place, that you're just explaining things away, you're just coming up with stories. But evolutionary psychology too is now finding ways of creating models, making predictions, testing hypotheses, and entering the same scientific realm as all other branches of science. So I think it's now unfair to have a bad attitude towards evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology. It is a perfectly good scientific endeavor.
Would you talk about the contention with evolutionary biology, and then in particular with your book Sperm Wars?
I think the main problem that the general public has with evolutionary biology and also with sperm wars, which of course was written for the general public. The scientific work was written in papers by myself and Mark Bellis, and we also published a book called Human Sperm Competition, which dealt with the science of it. But sperm wars was aimed at the general public, and I think the main thing that people wrestle with when they read something like Sperm Wars is the sort of conflict between the idea that they are in control of their behaviour and the idea that their body is actually generating an awful lot of that behaviour that they aren't aware of, and they're not, certainly not totally in control of it, though of course there can be a certain amount of control. I think the main thing that people struggle with is this idea they're not totally in control of their behaviour. An awful lot of their behaviour is being generated through urges by other things in their body, mainly the genes that produce the chemicals, the hormones and so on, that change the way people behave and give them the urges that they feel. It's this question, am I in control of my behavior or aren't I? If you're hungry and you ask yourself, what do I feel like eating? Now that question, you're searching your body really for advice on what it is that you need to eat. And you think, oh no, I don't really feel like that. Oh no, I don't really feel it. And then you say, but what I could really do with is a banana, which could be your body saying, look, you're a bit short on potassium. What you need is a source of potassium. You may not even know that banana's got potassium, but your body knows the sort of things that gives it what it's lacking at the moment. It is telling you what to do. And so you think, yeah, I really must have a banana. And on a bigger scale, the same is true for sexual behavior. For example, it's not good for men at most ages to go more than about 3 days without shedding some of their ejaculate, because the sperm are aging, they're not going to be as fertile next time. And we've talked about this, having the right ejaculate, but beyond a certain length of time, it's not good. And the male gradually builds up an urge to ejaculate. And if he can't do it through intercourse, then he does it through masturbation. It's the body saying to him, look, you've got to get rid of this older part of your ejaculate. You don't want them in there. This isn't conscious. He's not saying, oh, yes, I really must get rid of my old sperm. That's not good. He's just got this urge to masturbate or to ejaculate in some way, and so he follows that urge. And even more subtle things are going on. We talked earlier about men, when they have sex with their partner, if they've reason to think she may have been unfaithful, they inseminate more sperm than if they've spent all their time with her and they're perfectly content that there's been absolutely no chance of her being unfaithful, then they inseminate fewer sperm. But nobody, no man is sort of having sex with his partner and thinking, should I put in 400 million now or 200 million? How many should I put in? He doesn't need to. His body takes full control of that. It will decide how much of his ejaculate goes in. And a woman too, after intercourse, we talked about the flow back earlier. Nobody's suggesting that a woman can lie there and think, right, how much of this sperm should I get rid of when I urinate? Should I get rid of all of it, half of it? You know, the body will judge these things for it. It has all the information that it needs to make these sort of decisions. It's not a cerebral decision at all. That doesn't mean the brain isn't involved in some, just in the same way as once your body decides you need a banana, the brain says, yes, but there isn't one for half a mile or whatever, or it's too expensive there. The brain then becomes involved in other aspects of it. And, of course, over decisions like to be unfaithful or not, although the urge to be unfaithful may be there, that you have very little control over, it's a question of attraction and urges and so on, the brain can, of course, make some decisions over this as to how it's going to affect your life and the lives of other people around you, and decisions can be made. And most of the time, they can override what the body is generating. But, you see, if there's any doubt about the way the body responds to the chemicals inside, you've only got to imagine the effect of alcohol. If somebody drinks too much alcohol, for example, and reduces the brain's ability to make its decisions, then, of course, everybody knows that people become less inhibited. They are more likely to make rash decisions and do things that they wouldn't if they hadn't had that alcohol. It's a chemical that is affecting the person's behaviour. Give a man too much testosterone and he behaves differently from if you give him a more female-type hormone. And women behave differently during different phases of their menstrual cycle purely because of the balance of estrogen and progesterone. They get much more adventurous and much more and walk around even a lot more during the middle part of their cycle. We are under the control of chemicals, and the brain only has a sort of guiding influence on this. It can't stop those urges, and sometimes it can't even override them, which is where, of course, an awful lot of problems arise. So, yes, this is unsettling, I think, for everyone, general public and scientists themselves, who are also behaving, of course. But I think that is one of the problems that sperm was confronted when it was released for a general audience. The release for scientists, of course, raised different matters. The most familiar example of the body taking over people's urges over food, most people will have heard of. That's what happens during early pregnancy for women. During that phase, it's well known that women can develop the most bizarre cravings for this or that food, as well as developing some really intense dislikes for food that they have eaten regularly in the past before getting pregnant. It's the perfect example of the body taking over a woman's food preferences. And usually you can see some sense in what she's desiring and what she's giving up in terms of what she might be lacking and what might be good for the baby. It's a really good example of this taking place.
Reflecting back on some of the critiques and put-downs, for example, by Tim Burkhead in dismissing evidence of different categories of sperm, I was curious on your thoughts if this was coming from professional jealousy or attempts to discredit that might align with an agenda such as anti-evolutionary biology.
Yes, the response from the scientific community was, as you'd expect, I suppose, rather different from that of the general public that sperm wars addressed. Very little of the criticisms that we did get from the scientific community had anything to do with evolutionary biology. In fact, the only area I can think of was over the female orgasm. We had some criticism from people who were anti-evolutionary biology there. For example, one of the theories about female orgasm is that it's an artifact. Because males have to have orgasms in order to ejaculate in reproduction, females have orgasm as a result of that. It's a bit like saying that that males have nipples, which are useless, because females have nipples, which are functional. The argument was that the female orgasm has no function, but it only exists because males have evolved orgasms. So that in itself actually is an evolutionary argument, but it's not the sort of evolutionary biology based on reproductive success that Mark Bellis and I were concerned with. All the other criticisms that we got from the scientific community weren't concerned with that. They were concerned with experimental design and results and replicability, all the proper scientific criticisms. That's how science should work. Other people are praising your results. We have to remember that when Mark Bellis and I started doing our work, there was no field of human sperm competition. Nobody had done anything like this before. We had to start from scratch. We had to come up with all our own ways of investigating the subject. By the time we'd finished, 10 years later, we had a book worth of new ideas, new hypotheses, loads of experiments, loads of results, plus our interpretations of these experiments and results. So a lot had happened in those 10 years. And naturally, when you start a field, as we did, you're going to get some things right and some things wrong. And science then works to try and work out which of these are good ideas and which of them aren't such good ideas. To be honest, most of the things that we have said weren't dismissed at all. People took them on board. They have become subjects for study in their own right. And I would say more of the things that we have said are now accepted and are part of biological work and taken seriously. The only real situation that created a lot of criticism or antagonism, I'm not quite sure what the word is. It came over our work on killer sperm, because we'd mixed sperm together and we'd shown that after nothing happened for the first 6 hours, but after 6 hours, sperm started to kill more sperm than if they were just with sperm of their own male, as we talked about earlier. And a biologist called Tim Burkhead, who actually was a student of mine, he went on to become a leading light in the field of bird sperm competition, and he has very generously credited me with getting him started and getting him interested in that. But when it came to human sperm competition, he didn't like it. He didn't like the idea. He didn't like our experiments. Him and a team set out to repeat our killer sperm work, our killer sperm experiments. They did their own mixing experiments. But bizarrely, I can't imagine why, because they'd seen our work. They stopped their research, their experiments after 3 hours. By that time, we'd got no effect of mixing sperm from different males either. And they published a paper that said, we can find no evidence of killer sperm. But of course they wouldn't. They'd only done it for 3 hours. If they carried on their experiments for another 9 hours, hopefully they would have got the same results as us, but they never did. But they published this paper, and the rumour has sort of spread through the field that that our experiments didn't replicate. But in fact, as far as they went, they did replicate them. They just didn't go far enough.
Professor Baker, with the knowledge of this hidden biological activity motivating subconscious behavior in the public domain now for a few decades, have you or your colleagues noticed any related social change?
Well, I'd love to be able to say, of course, that that evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology, with perhaps sperm wars playing its own small part, had led to some sort of change in the way humans view this balance between internal urges and hormonal systems and subconscious behavior and the way people really behave. Really, I think the biggest acknowledgement of this phenomenon took place decades or even centuries ago, when lawmakers in many parts of the world decided that in the first few months or year after giving birth, a woman was gripped by such strong emotions and hormonal changes, or however they saw it at the time, was gripped by such strong emotions that she couldn't necessarily control her feelings towards her child, and was almost unable to stop herself from killing the child or abandoning it or whatever. That was a real recognition that this was taking place, that this control of behavior by subconscious things caused by hormones was taking place. And in many ways, the crime of passion verdicts that existed in France and other places is also a recognition of the way that emotions can sometimes override the brain's decisions. And all of these decisions were made in the past. But I think, to be totally honest, I'd have to say that the way society is moving at the moment towards interpreting the interactions between men and women, particularly over sex, is maybe even taking less recognition of the strength of these evolved behaviours. And of course, society's got every right to make whatever decision it likes over how urges should interact with control by the brain. All evolutionary biology and psychology can do is to give opinions onto why these urges and instincts exist. The evolutionary biologists aren't moralists. They just explain why things happen, not whether they should happen or not. As for sperm wars itself, I don't think I'm really in a position to say whether that's had any contribution to what is happening in this respect over the last couple of decades since it was published. The only insight I've really got is from the from the letters that I receive from people, and I've had many, many messages and letters. Sperm Wars has been translated into 25 different languages. It's been published on all continents, I mean, apart from Antarctica. And I've had a lot of people commenting on the content of Sperm Wars. I've had my fair share of women who have complained that the book gives men far too many excuses for the way they behave. I've had just about an equal number, I think, from men saying that the book gives too many excuses for the way women behave over infidelity and so on. They just about balance out. But by far the biggest weight of communications I've had from readers over the years has actually been in gratitude over the contents of Sperm Wars has allowed them to understand better why they at least felt the way they did going through their sexual lives, and in many ways helped them to understand how they did actually behave as well as how they felt. And I've also had a fair number from bisexuals, because the chapters in Sperm Wars that deal with bisexuality seem to have been generally well received by the people who are most interested in them. So I'm quite happy that Sperm Wars has added its contribution to people's understanding of their sexual behaviour. But changing social behaviour as a whole, I'd like to say yes, but I think it's probably not had a great deal of effect.
Dr. Robin Baker, thank you once again for being on the show and delivering such an in-depth interview on your book, Sperm Wars, The Science of Sex. Your research pulls back the curtain on how ancient programming in our bodies influences the subconscious and motivates our behavior. I do appreciate this documentation because it's a revelation of self-awareness when you begin to grasp this research. Thank you again for being on In Other News.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.